Eddie snuck onto the plane. Dina was sure of that. As for Master Guns, the light was on in his office, though based on the open door, Master Guns wasn't there. In the corner, Colonel Sue's light was on as well. Her door was shut. This early in the day? She and Master Guns were both inside. Dina made a mental note. By now, back at the bowling alley, at the Kingpin Cafe, the first pot of coffee should finally be done brewing. Throwing back a few more M&Ms and still humming If I Could Turn Back Time, Dina wheeled the hand truck through the office, toward the front door. The few secretaries he passed didn't even bother looking up. That's how it was. Every day. No one looked twice at the Candyman.
79. First, Wags called Zig. No answer. She called him again. Same. Straight to voicemail. Didn't even ring. Like his phone was off. Then Wags called Master Guns. Same. No answer. She called again. Still no answer, but it rang three times. He wasn't picking up. She sent Master Guns a text. You there? No response. And then, those three gray dots appeared, the ellipses that told her Master Guns was writing back. In a meeting. All okay? Master Guns texted. No, emergency. Call me, she texted back. Can't, with Colonel, and seek service. Base going on lockdown. You safe? Wags stood there at her adjustable height desk, debating whether to text the words. She had no choice. I know who Horatio is, she hit send. The three gray dots came up immediately, then disappeared as her phone rang, vibrating in her hand. You're on speaker, Master Guns announced as she picked up. I have Colonel Sue and Agent Terry O'Hara from the U.S. Secret Service. You were saying about Horatio?
I know who he is, Wags insisted. I found fingerprints on the fang.
That doesn't mean...
I looked through Dover's entrance records, checking to see when he swiped into the building. He's there every time Zig is, leaves every time Zig leaves. He's been watching all along, she added, pulling up an image on her phone and hitting send. There was a pause and a buzz as the image popped up on Master Guns' phone screen. That's him! That's Horatio! Wags said, still staring at the employee photo of the one man who had access to every building at Dover. The one man who knew everything Zig was up to. Dino.
80. At Dover, most buildings had names. The military is tidy. It prefers names. So, officially, the mortuary was known as the Charles C. Carson Center for Mortuary Affairs. The military museum where Dover stored dozens of old classic airplanes was called the Air Mobility Command Museum. But the building Dina was currently headed to as he carried a large cardboard box with a Snickers logo on it? Building 1303. That's what it was called on Dover's official maps. But to those who worked on base, it had another name. The Graveyard. A bit melodramatic, to be sure. But as Dina readjusted the Snickers box and eyed the security force's black SUV in the distance, even Dina had to admit, it was an apt name. Back in 1978, during the Jonestown Massacre, Preacher Jim Jones asked his followers to drink cyanide-laced grape punch, killing over 900 people, including over 200 children. Since Dover specializes in mass fatalities, 913 corpses were sent here. But with a number that large, the only way to store the bodies was to convert an old 1960s-era metallic warehouse into a massive morgue. Building 1303. Anybody home? Dino called out toward the warehouse's broken windows, which were boarded up. He didn't like coming here. No one liked coming here. Not since those 900 Jonestown corpses were covered in white sheets and spread out across the warehouse's concrete floor. When it happened, The then colonel at Dover said to give it time, that people would eventually forget and the building could be put back into regular use. It almost worked, until a decade ago, when a C-5 Galaxy, the military's largest plane at the time, over 6 stories high, took off from a runway at Dover and mysteriously crashed right after it flew over this exact spot. No one on the plane was killed. Voodoo, everyone called it, blaming it once again on Building 1303, one of the few places at Dover that people actively avoided. "Hello? Anyone?" Dino called out again, crossing around to the side of the warehouse and checking one last time over his shoulder. The military SUV was long gone. This far south on the base, there were only long, barren cornfields on one side of the building and a scattering of parked airplanes on the other. Using his chest to pin the cardboard box to the wall, Dino reached for the rusted old doorknob and gave it a tug. He knew it'd be open. He unlocked it days ago. "Delivery!" Dino called out, stepping inside and ignoring the metallic whiff of wet coins and rusted old pipes. It was dark inside. They shut off the electricity years ago, the only light coming from a boarded-up skylight that wasn't boarded up as well as it should be. "Back here," a man's voice called out. Dino glanced to his left, where stack after stack of 1950s-era gurneys, at least 2,000 of them, were piled one on top of another, each stack 10 feet high, forming makeshift walls and an instant maze that Dino followed deeper into the wide warehouse. After 9/11, when the Iraq invasion began, the government was keenly aware that every new war brings a massive increase in dead young soldiers. To handle the demand, Dover got $30 million for a new mortuary, filled with $10 million in state-of-the-art equipment. But as all the new items arrived, everything from the old mortuary, which dated back to Vietnam and Korea, had to be thrown away, or at least stored somewhere no one would notice. "You're late," the man's voice called out. "I'm doing my best," Dino replied. He meant it. His entire life, Dino worked hard, but somehow, it was never good enough. In high school, he barely passed. In community college, he scraped by. As a valet, an ice cream store manager, a piercing pagoda employee, even a health club trainer, he struggled, struggled, and struggled. Even now, as he tried to pick up his pace, it led to more stumbling. Dino was a big guy, with a big gut, who lumbered when he walked. "Wait, that's not... Where'd you go?" Dino called out, hitting a dead end down an aisle of 30-foot-high metallic racks that flanked him on both sides. Back during Vietnam, these casket racks held all the new caskets, 6,000 at a time, when the war was at its peak. Now they were filled with old desk chairs, lamps, and leftover office furniture. "Did I tell you this place was something?" Dino shouted, double-backing down a different aisle, still trying to navigate the stacks of old metal desks, battered embalming tables, vintage casket carriages, 50-gallon drums of formaldehyde, as well as metal storage racks filled with scalpels, forceps, draining tubes, separators. Every mortician's tool you can think of, all smelling like mildew and decay, all covered in rotten rust, like an entire 1960s funeral home was dumped into a warehouse and forgotten. "By the way, you were right about Zig," Dino called out, his arms holding tight to his cardboard box. "According to the entry records, he came in first thing this morning, driving a hearse. That means Nola was probably in back, huh?" No answer. "You hear what I said?" Dino added, cutting around a huge wooden crate marked, "Warning, carcinogens" in bright red letters. The crate was filled with glass bottles of embalming fluid. "That means Nola..." "What's in the box?" a deep voice interrupted. Dino spun toward a man with buzzed gray hair, a pitted face, and a faded scar that split his bottom lip in a pale zigzag from where it was torn open years ago. Dressed in tan and green camouflage, an army combat uniform, the man stood there, arms behind his back, his greedy eyes taking Dino apart.
Jesus on a pogo stick. Don't do that, Dino blurted. I hate scary movies.
The box. What's in it? The man asked. Dino hesitated. But not for long. It's for my payment. You said you'd... I know what I said. From behind his back, the man pulled out a manila envelope, thick with cash. If it makes you feel better, you did the right thing. Dino grabbed the money, then turned away, studying the envelope and avoiding eye contact. He took no joy in what he'd done. But at this point, he didn't have a choice. Not with all the debt he was buried under. It started 6 months ago, when his old manager from Piercing Pagoda told him about an opportunity to get in on the ground floor. A brand new PVC piping company. With the filament it used, you could make it yourself on a 3D printer. Miraculous, everyone called it. A game changer. Dino looked it up. It all checked out. Together, they could buy the distributorship for the entire East Coast. This was Dino's chance. His chance to get away from the candy machines, to get out of the bowling alley. His chance to step out of Zig's shadow and finally build something for himself. Something that Zig didn't help him with. All he had to do was pull together the cash. His savings, second mortgage, plus the $20,000 he borrowed from his bookie. Sure, it was a risk. But what great reward came without risk? This was Dino's chance. Unfortunately, it was also a scam, one that took Dino for nearly $250,000. For months, he thought he could dig out. Then Dino's car got repossessed. He told Zig it was in the shop. Then the bookie sent a guy who wore a gold razor blade around his neck. A few times Dino was tempted to ask Zig for help. But God almighty, he'd spent his whole life asking Zig for help. Eventually, the banks stopped calling and instead started knocking on his door. They threatened to take his house, his wages. They even started going after the joint account his grandmother asked him to co-sign so Dino could help pay her rent and bills. She was 93. If they took that account, Grandma Ruth would be out on the street. So when a man approached Dino, offering to pay Dino's debts, Dino knew there had to be a catch. And there was. All Dino had to do was tell the man where Zig was going and what he was up to. Are you out of your mind? Dino replied. No way. He'd never screw over his friend. That is, until the man explained that he didn't want to hurt Zig either. He just wanted information. Where Zig was on base. Who he was talking to. If anything, considering the people Zig was investigating, it would save Zig's life. More important, the man explained, if Dino wouldn't help, he'd find someone else who would. It was that last point that Dino couldn't argue with. At least this way, Dino could keep an eye on everything, managing the situation and keeping Zig safe. Did Dino feel bad that day when he knocked Zig in the head? Of course. He felt awful. But at that point, to grab Camille's items from the room and to make sure Zig didn't spot him, Dino had no choice. Keeping Zig in the dark meant keeping Zig safe. Plus, with the influx of cash, Dino could pay off his debts, keep his car and house, and pay for Grandma Ruth. All of his financial problems would disappear. Like magic. You hear what I said about Zig in the hearse? Dino asked, staring down as he clutched the envelope of money, tempted to open it. Somehow, though, it felt rude. I'm telling you, Nola's on that plane to Alaska. No, the man said quietly. She isn't. There was something in the man's voice. Something that made Dino want to turn around. He didn't, though. How do you know? Those would be the final words Dino ever uttered. Behind him, Dino didn't see the man pull out his gun. Didn't hear as the man cocked a bullet into the chamber. Dino was too busy dropping the envelope into his cardboard Snickers box, congratulating himself for picking such a good hiding place. Dino, the man said. Following the sound, Dino glanced over his shoulder.
The gun was already at Dino's temple, the angle just right, so when they later found the gun, along with a pile of collection notices, even the best investigators would be convinced it was a suicide. A jagged black hole appeared in Dino's temple, burn marks scorching his skin. His head whipped sideways, chasing the bullet, followed by his torso, then his body, all his weight dragged to the side like a toppling tree. Thud. As Dino hit the concrete floor, a single spurt of blood gushed like a tiny waterfall down his temple, across the side of his nose, then another. That was it. For a moment, the man with the pale zigzag scar stood there. He wasn't looking at Dino. He was staring straight ahead, out into the warehouse. "I know you're here," he called. No one replied. "You think I'm a fool?" the man added. "You followed Dino here, didn't you, Nola?" There was a noise on his left, a click, like a gun being cocked. From behind a tall stack of 1950s metal desks, Nola just stood there, her gun pointed at the man. "Horatio, huh?" Nola asked. "That's what you're calling yourself now?" The man laughed, a soulful, hearty laugh that came from deep in his belly. The man who knew IDs better than anyone. "Don't be so formal, Nola." "I know it's been a while," Royal said, flashing his wolfish grin. "But you can still call me Dad."
81. Homestead, Florida. 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16. On the day she almost didn't make 17. Royal was screaming about mayonnaise.
"Did you taste it? It turned! Went bad!" he shouted, gripping his sandwich in a fist, shoving it toward Nola's face.
She was trying to clean up lunch, hoping to get out of there. At the smell of the sandwich, she recoiled.
"You smell that, right? Shit smell like that and you still served it to me?"
Avoiding eye contact, Nola stayed focused on wiping crumbs from the counter.
"Why would you serve it if it smelled like that?"
Nola stayed silent.
"Answer me!"
Nola paused. He asked again. Finally, she whispered,
"It smelled fine before."
That was it. Fuse lit.
"Fine? You think this is fine? Or better yet?"
Royal opened the fridge, pulled out the old tub of mayo, a massive Price Club size that had been sitting in the fridge for the better part of a year, and quickly unscrewed it, ramming the open tub toward Nola's face. Again, she recoiled at the smell.
"You think I'm a fucking moron? You did it on purpose, didn't you?"
Royal asked, hitting his own next level.
"You knew it was spoiled and you served it!"
Nola shook her head, but it was true. She thought the mayo might have turned. It was a small victory, but she'd take it. Like when she'd spit in his pancake batter every Sunday.
"Okay, smartass. If it's good enough for me, then it's good enough for you,"
Royal insisted. From the counter, he grabbed at a ceramic utensil holder, knocking it over and sending two whisks and a metal cheese grater flying across the counter. From the utensil holder, he pulled out a wooden spoon, scraped it inside the tub, and pulled out a big dollop of mayo, like a runny scoop of ice cream. He rammed it at Nola's face.
"Come on, you think it's so good, take a bite."
Nola kept her head down, trying to sidestep him.
"Take a bite!"
Nola shoved his hand aside.
"Get off!"
she blurted, already regretting it. In a blur, Royal slapped her across the face so hard, blood flew from her mouth. She knew that taste. The coppery tang of blood wasn't new to her. She was still getting her bearings. He grabbed her by the throat.
"I said, take a bite,"
he growled, tightening his grip around her neck and slowly moving the spoon of mayonnaise to her lips, like he was feeding a baby. The cloud of mayo smelled foul, looking thicker and yellower than it should. Nola shook her head back and forth, her lips pressed together. Royal held tight to her throat, and with a violent shove backward, half a dozen wooden spoons and the cheese grater fell to the floor. Royal lifted her up on her tiptoes. Nola couldn't breathe. Her face was tomato red.
"Eat it,"
he rumbled, his breath matching the smell of the lumpy glob of mayo that was now touching her lips. Nola had no choice. She opened her mouth to gasp for breath. The sour mayonnaise passed her lips, and she felt it coat the front of her teeth, then the roof of her mouth. She swallowed hard, using her tongue to force it down. It was like eating a pudding of bad eggs.
"All of it,"
Royal said, still gripping her throat. She gagged on the first bite, then gagged again, her body violently jerking.
"Don't you dare throw up!"
Too late. A thick spray of Nola's salami lunch spewed through the air. Royal stepped out of the way just in time. It landed in a thick Jackson Pollock splatter across the linoleum. At the sight of it, Royal tightened his fists.
"You think you're done?"
he screamed. She tried to run. He grabbed her by the hair, then the back of her neck, her body bending backward like a childhood game of limbo. She was off balance and falling. Royal held tight, twisting her around, forcing her to her knees. He pushed her face toward the floor until her nose was inches from the vomit.
"I said all of it."
Nola pushed back, trying to raise her head. Royal held her in place. Nola was shaking, the bile smell bringing tears to her eyes, mucus running from her nose.
"All of it. Lick it up,"
Royal insisted. And then Nola whispered the one thing that she'd never said in 10 years.
"No,"
she muttered the word to herself. But Royal could feel it, could sense it, even if he couldn't hear it.
"What did you just say?"
Royal never finished the question. Down on the ground, mucus dangling from her nose into the vomit, Nola reached for the nearby cheese grater. Gripping it in her fist, she swung backward with all her might. The metal grater caught Royal in the face. It tore open his bottom lip, taking with it a hunk of skin that ran down his jaw. He'd have this zigzag scar forever.
"Nah!"
Royal screamed, Nola already all over him.
"You don't get to touch me! You never get to touch me!"
she howled, clawing at his face, at his throat, at his eyes, snot still raining from her nose. A flurry of punches spread the blood from Royal's cheek, now covering her fists. She even kicked at his left knee, remembering when he twisted it a few years back. In a matter of seconds, a decade of rage erupted and overflowed. For a moment, she thought she'd won. But Nola had never been trained to fight. And as she wound up with another punch, Royal planted his meaty fist directly into her left eye. The singular blow turned Nola's world black, then bright with stars. She flew backward, crashing into the sink and tumbling to the floor. The cheese grater went flying. She couldn't hear a thing. Royal had hit her before, but never with a ferocity like this.
"You're dead! You hear me?"
he screamed, letting out a roar as spit flew from his lips. In a blur, he gripped her by the hair and dragged her to her feet. His eyes were dark, like she wasn't even there. Nola thought she'd seen all his levels. She'd never seen this one. He wasn't cursing, wasn't screaming, wasn't even calling her his nigger. No, he was simply silent. Gripping the back of her neck, Royal thrust her toward the back screen door, using her forehead to shove it open, tossing her outside. Her toes dragged through the grass as they headed for... Of course. A vicious kick sent the kiddie pool flying across the yard, but instead of shouting a time at Nola... 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour. Royal tossed her into the hole. She landed on her side, her shoulder on fire, dislocated.
"Lay down."
"Royal,
lay down,"
he snarled, his voice booming through the backyard. She did, well aware of what would happen if she didn't. The blood was still pouring from his face.
Royal, please don't do this.
He already was, leaping in after her and grabbing the shovel.
You move, and I'll put this in your heart, he said coldly,
standing over her and pressing the point of the shovel into her chest.
You understand?
She nodded, lying there on her back, her shoulder burning. Climbing out of the hole, Royal slid the blade under a mound of fresh dirt that was at the foot of the shallow pit. She wanted to scream, wanted to cry.
No!
Even he wouldn't do this. He lifted the shovel full of dirt into the air and didn't pause. He dumped it on Nola. As the dirt rained down, she was coughing, gasping, trying to shield her face. She could feel it sticking to the slurry of snot under her nose, the musky smell of dirt. It wouldn't take much to cover her. Royal loaded up again with another round of fresh dirt. Nola looked up at him, pleading. He stared down straight into her eyes, unblinking, like there was no one inside his head. With a twist of his wrists, he dumped the dirt on her again. And again. And again. Nola shut her eyes, spitting between each shovelful. Her legs were covered first, then her waist, the heavy blanket of dirt feeling like 1,000 pounds. She should run. Run now!
Don't you move, he warned as she started to squirm.
He won't go through with it. Even he wasn't that nuts, Nola told herself. He was just making a point.
But then she thought back all those years ago, to that first night of digging, in South Carolina. He said it from the start. She was digging her own grave. A clump of dirt hit her chest as she covered her eyes. She cupped her hands together, trying to make a little air pocket for her face. Another clump hit. She was spitting, her breathing heavy now. Her lungs were ready to burst.
No, don't hyperventilate.
A clump hit her in the waist, then another in the neck. Since they moved here, it took most of the year for her to dig this hole. It took Royal less than 5 minutes to fill it. Nola was covered now, up to her neck. Royal stomped the blade into the dirt, scooping out his final mounds. Nola's hands were still cupped over her face. She thought about praying, but learned long ago there'd be no answer. Instead, she went to a different place, tried to imagine a better place than this. It wasn't hard. She could see it in her mind's eye, saying the words for the first time.
Mongol, Faber, Statler, Ticonderoga, Swan.
Another clump hit right at her wrists.
Mongol, Faber, Statler, Ticonderoga, Swan.
And then, the next clump of dirt never came. Royal stood there.
Had enough? He asked.
Nola's hands were shaking. She lifted them up, letting the light in. Spit again. Blinked away the dirt. She could barely see Royal. He was standing there at the foot of the hole. She lifted her head for a better look. Blood ran from his chin, his lower lip looking like it wasn't attached. Down in the hole, Nola was covered up to her neck, her head the only thing still free. Dirt was in her ears, in her nose, in her teeth, in her hair. Another good shovelful and she'd be completely under.
You better learn your place,
Royal warned, his voice low and steady, sounding slurred from his cut lip.
You understand?
Nola's own lips were pursed. She was breathing heavily, short, quick bursts to keep the dirt from her throat.
You understand?
He repeated. She nodded over and over and over.
I'm sorry. So sorry,
she gasped, meaning it. With a flick of his wrists, Royal tossed a final shovelful of dirt onto her face. Not enough to cover her, just to remind her of the consequences. She spit out most of the dirt, her face still covered in mucus and saliva. By the time she looked up, Royal was headed back to the house.
Let's go,
he called out. The dirt wasn't packed tight. With a little effort, she sat up straight. Her eye was already swelled shut from where he punched her. The shovel was at her feet. She spit out more dirt, her head still ringing.
"How you feeling?"
Royal asked. She kept her head down, not answering as she used the shovel like a crutch, crawling up from the hole.
"You look like a zombie,"
Royal teased, seeing all the mud and filth still stuck to her.
"Don't get that shit in the house,"
he added, heading for the back door. As Royal stepped inside, even from here, Nola could smell the acidic stench of salami vomit that was still sprayed across the kitchen floor.
"What a hot damn mess,"
he called out, nearly tripping over the tub of mayonnaise turned on its side, which spun like a top into the mayo-covered spoon he'd used to force-feed her. Behind him, through the screen door, Nola was outside, taking off her clothes. She made sure he wasn't peeking. For those few moments, he did the right thing, giving her some privacy. Then, for no reason, he turned just slightly, glancing over his shoulder. Just a little peek. Just as Nola was winding up.
"Nola, you better get in here and clean this shit up."
Clang! The side of the shovel hit Royal with a wallop as it smashed him in the temple. Wielding the shovel like a baseball bat, Nola had swung with all her might. At the impact, Royal's head twisted so hard it looked like it was about to unscrew from his neck. For Nola, the sound alone, a sickening bone crack of metal against skin, was worth it. Royal's body corkscrewed, bouncing off the kitchen counter and crumpling to the floor. Nola wound up for another hit, but Royal was already slumped across the ground, unconscious. That day, Nola ran 9 miles, not stopping until she reached Ms. Sable's house. By the time the police arrived at Nola's place, Royal was long gone. It would be the last time Nola and Royal saw each other, until that frozen afternoon out by the runway in Alaska.
82. MK Air Base, Constanța, Romania, 4 months ago. "Okay to sit?" asked the man with the long eyelashes and pale zigzag scar across his lip. "Free country," the man named Rowan replied. "At least I think it's still free." His fox-shaped face contorted as he took a bite of his steak sandwich. The two of them sat in the PX food court, both of them eating over red plastic trays from Charlie's steak sandwiches, a little piece of home on this Air Force base in Romania. "How's the steak?" "Crappy." "And amazing," Rowan said, barely looking up. "So, like all PX food," the man with the scar joked, his voice like a wood chipper. Rowan didn't answer. He was eating faster now, trying to get out of here. "That one of ours," the man added, motioning with his chin toward the small computer case that sat next to Rowan's red tray. "Yeah? Why?" The man took a bite of his own steak sandwich, grease and oil raining from the bottom. A few determined chews. Swallowed it quick, licked his lips. "You're the one they call Houdini. The paying agent, yeah? Usually they ship you around place to place, but they said you got assigned to Colonel Price's unit. I hear you do amazing work. Can make all sorts of things disappear." Houdini sat up straight, his glare tightening on the man with the zigzag scar. No uniform. Green stripe across his ID. "You're a contractor?" "For Colonel Price's unit. Welcome to Blue Book." "You been with them long?" Rowan asked. The man nodded. "I get our people the right paperwork. It's more important than you think. But I also make sure that no one tries to rip us off. And that's what caught my eye here. You said that computer there is one of ours, but if it is, you should have filled out a hand receipt. But when I looked, I didn't see a hand receipt from you. Which makes me wonder, why is the new guy suddenly carrying a computer bag without a computer?" "I use it for storage. I like the bag. It's a good bag. Probably holds, what,
about 11 pounds. That's heavy. Equal to a big bag of sugar, a medium bowling ball. Or if you use those bricks of cash we pay people in, 11 pounds is about $500,000. Give or take. The man gripped his steak sandwich, squeezing the grease and oil from it. I should run, Houdini said, starting to stand. I got a flight to catch. I noticed. I also noticed that everyone else in Blue Book is flying out of here first thing tomorrow morning, the colonel included. But for some reason, according to the manifest, you're flying out in the next few hours. Why are you rushing away from us? Houdini froze there a moment, midway between standing up and sitting. Then he sat down. I should probably get running myself, the man added. If a computer goes missing, or even a computer bag, it's good to file a report. That way they can check everyone's belongings before they fly out. You wouldn't believe what people take from here. He looked straight at Houdini, who looked straight back. What did you say your name was again? Houdini asked. I didn't, Royal replied as he went to get up. Again, I should run. Wait, wait, wait. Before you go, Houdini said, maybe we should have ourselves a talk.
83. Deutsch Air Base, Copper Center, Alaska. 5 days ago. Nola was staring at a hole in the ceiling when she made the decision. She didn't remember what caused her to look up. A stray bird that swooped through the airplane hangar? But there it was. A pinprick of light shining through the roof. She couldn't help but wonder what caused it. A squirrel? Hail? No. A gun. In every army base on the planet, including this tiny outpost near the National Park in Alaska, there was a roof with a stray bullet hole.
Passengers, head to the aircraft. Prepare to board.
A young airman with droopy eyes called out.
And please don't leave any trash in my terminal.
A small group of passengers collected their belongings by the bench area, readying their boarding passes. At the front of the group was an older man in a wool winter coat. He was the VIP, Librarian of Congress Nelson Rookstuhl. Leading the pack, he headed quickly toward the tarmac and the Air Force tech sergeant gripping a clipboard. Holding her own boarding card, Nola was about to join them, but right there, as she stared up at the hole in the roof, she turned the other way.
Wait, you're leaving?
A female voice called out. Nola didn't hear her. She was already at the exit, pushing her way through the clear plastic strips that covered the doorframe and kept the warmth from leaking out.
Sergeant Brown! Sergeant Brown!
The woman added, barreling through the flaps, her breath making tiny clouds.
It's me! It's...
Nola turned, eyeing the young woman with the flat nose and silver cuff earrings. Nola knew exactly who she was. Intimately. Nola painted her portrait yesterday, even let her keep the canvas when she started crying over how beautiful it made her look. A moment that Nola still couldn't shake. Camille.
Sorry to bother you, Sergeant Brown. I just... on the flight. Are you going?
Nola studied her, Camille once again leading with her squinty eyes. At her neck hung a pair of aviator sunglasses.
Why?
Nola asked.
They gave me leave because of, you know.
Nola just stood there.
Anyway, I tried getting on this flight and they told me there were no more seats. But if you're not gonna...
Camille stopped, getting her first good look at Nola.
You okay, Sergeant Brown?
Nola was looking to her left toward the runway. Nearly a football field away, a snow-camouflaged Hummer was backed up toward the plane. A man in his mid-50s loaded supplies. It was him. Most definitely him. Nola first spotted him yesterday. She was getting in a car. It was just for a split second. But she'd never forget his face. Royal was here. On base.
You look like you've seen a ghost, Camille added.
She had. Nola was up all night debating what to do. For sure she'd seen him. But had he seen her? No, not yet. That was her advantage, and the only way to keep it was to stick to her schedule. Get on the plane, avoid attention. Now that she knew where he was, she could track him easily, even come back for him. Prepared. It was a fine plan, especially considering what she almost did last night with the shovel she found in a supply room. Yet now, as the Librarian of Congress climbed aboard the plane, and the pilot walked around it doing his final pre-flight checks, just the thought of Royal leaving? Of losing him again? No. After all these years, no way she could risk that. "I need to go," Nola said, still staring at Royal, who was out on the runway and loading a final box, a small suitcase, onto the plane.
"Because of him?"
Camille asked, following Nola's gaze. Nola turned. The girl was sharp, had a nose for details. Nola realized it yesterday while she was doing her portrait. It's why Nola had spent the past few years painting those who tried to take their own lives. People saw them as victims, and they were. But they were also much stronger than everyone thought.
"How do you know him?"
Camille asked. Nola didn't answer.
"Bad history, huh?" Camille said.
"Something like that." Camille nodded, more to herself, as Royal climbed into his snow-camouflaged Hummer.
"He looks old," Camille said. "Doesn't even look that tough."
"You have no idea," Nola blurted, hating herself for even saying something so stupid. Camille watched the way Nola stepped sideways out of his line of sight.
"You're really scared of him, huh?" Camille asked.
Nola didn't even hear the question. In her pocket, she was fidgeting with the colored pencils she carried everywhere. It was in that moment that Nola realized just how many of her old fears had settled back onto her chest. She didn't like it. "I need to go," Nola said, sidestepping Camille.
"Wait, wait, wait! Before you... What about your seat?"
"What?"
"Your seat on the plane. You know how the Air Force guys are. They said they already filed the manifest, that the plane was full. But if you let me take your spot..."
"I don't think so," Nola said. Right there, Royal glanced their way. For barely a second. Nola turned her head, making sure he didn't get a good look. Camille stood there watching. Finally, she whispered,
"What did he do to you?"
Nola shook her head like it was nothing. Camille didn't believe her. Soldiers were masters at hiding it, but just from her body language, Nola wasn't just looking at Royal. She was running from him.
"Is he on the flight?"
Nola shook her head no, her back still to Royal.
"Then come on. Switch with me. The next flight isn't for 3 days. I'll be back before you leave."
"Passengers, last call,"
the young airman shouted from inside. Unlike on commercial flights, once you check in, the military rarely rechecked IDs. They just looked to see if your name was on the manifest.
"Please, Sergeant Brown. After everything that happened, let me say it like this. I need a good weekend. Desperately. I've got a fiancé I haven't seen in weeks. He doesn't even know what I..."
She stopped herself again.
"I know it's stupid, but I'm trying to surprise him. It's his birthday."
Nola was about to say no. Then she noticed Camille's backpack. Sticking out of the top of it was a rolled poster. Not a poster. A canvas. The painting Nola did. Camille was taking it with her to show her fiancé. 12 days ago, Camille Williams did a whippet full of bug spray in the hopes of taking her own life. Today, she was bouncing anxiously on her heels, a pleading smile on her face. "Here," Nola said, handing over the boarding pass. For the next 10 seconds, Camille squeezed Nola in an exuberant hug, the happiest Nola had seen her. Camille didn't even realize Nola was just standing there, arms at her sides, not hugging back.
"You won't regret it,"
Camille said, darting toward the airplane hangar. As she plowed through the clear plastic strips, she took a final glance at Nola, who was still standing in the cold, her back to Royal.
"Last call," the airman with the clipboard shouted. "I'm looking for Nola Brown."
"That's me, sorry. Here I am,"
Camille added, running for the plane and waving her boarding pass like she'd just won the lottery.
"I'm Nola Brown."
84. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. Today.
You're never leaving this building. I'm gonna write your death in fire.
Death in fire? That's how you start our reunion?
Royal asked, a thin grin still on his lips.
After all these years, surely in your head you practiced something better than that.
Nola kept her gun pointed at him, just seeing her father again, getting a clear and close look at him. Royal was never a handsome man, but now, with his hair gray, the color of smoke, the way his face was thicker and puffier from age, life worked hard to wear him down. But as always, Royal fought against it. His knuckles were worn and red from those fights. He had the survival instincts of a rat, hustling and clawing his way out of whatever trap he was in. She saw it in his posture. Shoulders back, chest out. Someone taught him how to stand at attention. It gave him an air of authority, respectability. But Nola quickly tightened her glance. His feet weren't together. He carried all his weight on his left leg. Plus the way he cocked his camouflage cap, like John Wayne rather than the proper placement. Now, whoever he stole that uniform from, Royal wasn't proper military. Most likely a contractor.
You look tired, Nola. And angry as ever, Royal said, trying to make it sound like a compliment.
Age brought a calmness to his tone. He no longer clenched his fists when he spoke. But there are only so many things you can unlearn. As he turned her way, a glint of light hit his eyes. He always had such greedy eyes.
You really should let go of that anger, Royal added, taking a step toward her. It'll eat you up.
Don't. Don't move. Not another damn inch, she said, aiming her gun.
He didn't put his hands up. He just stood there a few feet from Dino's lifeless body.
How many years has it been, Nola? A dozen? If it makes you feel better, I'm not the man I used to be.
You tried to kill me.
No. You brought this on yourself.
Royal, this isn't... In Alaska, you did something to the plane, didn't you? You murdered those people. You killed Camille and the Librarian of Congress. You took 7 people's lives when you put that airplane down, and for what? Because you thought I was on it?
Did you hear what I said? This is on you, Nola. You're the one who came sniffing for trouble. I made something of myself. Do you have any idea how much we'd invested in Blue Book?
She did. She learned 2 days ago during her interrogation of Marcus on the boat. Blue Book was an old Harry Houdini trick, the way he'd reveal fake fortune tellers and also communicate with other magicians. Zig knew that. But what he didn't know, and what Nola didn't tell him, was that Blue Book's real moment came when one of Houdini's friends, a guy named John Elbert Wilkie, was put in charge of the U.S. Secret Service. Wilkie was a magician himself, and he admired the way Houdini used his own Blue Book to separate truth from lies when it came to the great beyond. Of course, the real secret of Houdini's Blue Book had nothing to do with speaking to the dead or returning from it. Its real power came from Houdini's people, who covertly found it and exposed it, the people who worked with Houdini and hid so perfectly in his audience during the show. It was a private corps made up of friends like Rose Mackenberg, Clifford Eddy, and Amadeo Vaca. The ultimate insiders. Over time, Wilkie turned Blue Book into a full-fledged government program, sneaking undercover agents and troops into key locations. It started during the Spanish-American War. When Teddy Roosevelt rode into battle, 3 U.S. sharpshooters were right there, secretly dressed as Cuban rebels, protecting Roosevelt and catching the Spanish army by surprise. A perfect trick, and a sure way to avoid death. By World War II, Blue Book had grown to 3 dozen Marines, all of them embedded in German physics labs, secretly reporting on the development of German weaponry. And by the 1980s, at the height of the Cold War, Blue Book had put 30 Navy SEALs into Russian language programs at universities around the country, since that's where the KGB did most of their recruiting. Today, Blue Book was still kept purposefully small, and had a permanent home on that university path, secretly enrolling our best soldiers in the nation's top university computer programs, from MIT to Caltech. Filled with students, and easily influenced social misfits, those programs were top targets for hacking and cyber terrorism recruiting. When Nola first learned of Blue Book, she was doubtful that the government would put that much energy into infiltrating civilian life. Then she started checking class rosters in the computer science labs at Stanford, Berkeley, and the University of Michigan. Among the skinny brainiacs and future Mark Zuckerbergs, she kept finding a beefy 30-year-old who'd spend every day getting great technical training while trying to hide his muscles in a cheap button-down shirt. Some blended in better than others. But one thing was clear. Even in the military, not all fighting happens with guns. In the end, to keep an eye on potential terrorists and to infiltrate anyone who would recruit them, the Blue Book soldiers were the ultimate observers, hiding in plain sight, just like Harry Houdini's hidden assistants. And to keep the program a secret, they'd run the entire operation out of the Library of Congress. Zig was right about that. That's why the president appointed a friend to manage the program. Just like Houdini, he needed someone he could trust. Also, with Rookstool on the plane, it provided the perfect cover story that the rest of the students could hide behind. With the Librarian of Congress on board, the last thing anyone suspected was an undercover operation. The big move covered the small one. But like any good magic trick, it only worked if everyone in the military kept their mouths shut. How'd you pull it off, Royal? Blue Book was classified at the topmost levels. So who was so dumb that they'd tell you about it?
You're making assumptions, Nola. Like I said, I'm not the man I used to be.
Nola wanted to rush at him right there. Wanted to stuff her thumbs into his Venus return and starve his heart as she told him he was full of shit. Not yet, though. Not until she got her answers. The day after she ran away, Royal changed his name. She knew that for sure. That's how he'd disappeared. New name, new driver's license. You must have loved using your skills on yourself. The thing is, you're still...
You don't know anything about me, Royal said. You have no idea who I became or what I gave up when I left you. My home, my contacts, my relationships, everything I built. Your damn art teacher sent the cops to Mr. Wesley. You took my life, he shouted, his voice ricocheting through the metal warehouse. All those years creating new identities, I helped give people a second chance. But to start my own life from scratch? You think you know what it's like, but you don't. I took you in. I gave you food. But to truly be out there alone? To leave my car behind because I couldn't fill it up? It was death, Royal said, swallowing hard, finding his calm. After a year, I eventually reached out to Mr. Wesley. My timing was perfect. He had a new job for me, a big one. 300 IDs plus backup documents. The group was coming in on a boat. It was my chance to rebuild. But neither of us knew that the feds were listening in. They never went away. They nabbed us both. It's a federal crime, so I...
You snitched, Nola said.
I made a deal.
You gave up Wesley and testified against him. Then the government what? They liked your work?
They loved my work. When the feds saw what I could do, they realized I didn't just forge documents, I forged lives. Do you have any idea how many uses the military has for that? They tested me at first. I was better than anyone they'd ever seen. Over time, they assigned me to Blue Book. I made new lives for our students, hiding Marines at universities around the country, providing them with a paperwork trail that was so untraceable you'd never guess we planted them there. This was my calling. I became a new man. I was resurrected, Nola. But do you know what my real trick was for coming back? Even now, when I look at the shitty life we had together and compare it with the new one I built, do you know what the difference was between the two? You, Nola. Once you were gone from my life, that's where I found success. And you want to know why? Because you're a fungus. You infect everything you touch. On my darkest days, I would spend hours focused on shedding my old life and making it disappear. But the truth was, all I needed to shed was you. And that's the great irony, Nola. Everything that's happened here, everything I've built, even everything I found with Blue Book and the death of that girl Camille, it's all thanks to you.
Nola shook her head. He was still the same manipulative ass. You know, for a few seconds, Royal, I almost believed you. I thought maybe you actually did make something of yourself with Blue Book. But no matter how high you rise, you're still just that low-life hustler, aren't you? She asked, her finger still tight on the trigger.
Watch your mouth.
Or what? You won't tell me how you blew it all up in your own face. It's not hard, Royal. Maybe at Blue Book you were doing good work for a while. But you were forever keeping your eye out, looking for an opening that you could jump all over. That's how you always operated, always working an angle. So let me guess. One day you found out the name of their paying agent, a guy they nicknamed Houdini. The warehouse was quiet now, Royal just standing there. He was no longer smiling. I'm right, aren't I? Nola added. Usually Houdini moved money to make the government's disasters disappear. But in this case, he became the disaster. Houdini was supposed to reach out to the undercover students, doling out little bits of money so no one could trace their funding back to Uncle Sam. But you realized he was dirty. And then you saw it, Royal, an opportunity.
You have no idea what you're talking about,
Royal said coldly. And you have no idea how predictable you are. Every few months, there's a greedy paying agent who gets arrested for skimming cash from all the money he's carrying around. That's who Houdini was, wasn't he? It's hard to make 30 grand a year, especially while he's trying to ignore the few million that he's dragging everywhere. For Houdini, who made things vanish, no one would notice if some extra cash flowed into his wallet as well, especially when a brand new pile of money was set to arrive. Nola knew that like any other military endeavor, Blue Book had its own operational requirements. At least twice a year they'd bring their undercover agents together to debrief and compare notes, usually in some isolated location, like an abandoned military base, or, in the case where specialists from Russia were brought in to talk about Putin's latest infiltration attempts, one that was tucked away in Alaska's nearby national park. That was where Houdini had planned to make his move. You found out about him, though, didn't you? You figured out that Houdini was skimming money from the cash that he was carrying around. Maybe you confronted him and asked for a piece of the action, though knowing you, you went in like a hammer, threatening to tattle on him unless he slid some of it your way. Maybe Houdini started cutting you in. Or maybe that's when he panicked and told you about the brand new pile of money they were about to send him for this special event in Alaska. Now you saw the chance for your favorite thing of all, the big payday, life-changing money, Royal. That's what you used to call it, right? And with all that cash suddenly coming, you couldn't resist. You're far too greedy. From there, you started using the nickname Horatio, and you and Houdini joined forces to take some, all, whatever it was. You were eyeing the massive pile of cash that was about to arrive in Alaska. Maybe you even called in a few of your old scumbag friends. Lord knows you always had plenty of those. The irony is, your Blue Book bosses were so busy bringing the Blue Book students in, they didn't even realize that Houdini and you, their paying agent and some greedy parasite who specialized in fake IDs, were about to rob them blind.
That's enough.
Was it your idea to go for the big haul? Or did you have enough dirt on Houdini that you talked him into it?
I said that's enough,
Royal growled, his head cocked just enough that Nola realized he was no longer making eye contact. Something was wrong, though her brain still hadn't registered it. Royal was looking past her. like he was talking to someone else. Someone behind her. Oh, shit. Nola was in mid-turn, cursing herself. He'd never come here by himself. There was a snap, like a chicken wing being ripped apart. Nola heard the noise before she felt the pain, a red-hot fire in her leg, as a sharp blade sliced the cord of her hamstring behind her knee. She fell backward instantly, like her body was a bike and her kickstand had been knocked over. Her head slammed into the concrete with a muted thud. The world went black, filled with stars. Don't pass out. She'd lived through plenty of pain, but not like this. Don't pass out. Her body twisted uncontrollably. She grabbed at her knee, writhing, rolling on her side. She blinked hard, trying to clear away the stars, but they were still twinkling. She started to scream.
No, don't scream. Don't give them that.
A black shadow appeared over her. Her attacker, moving like a blur, hovering over Nola as she continued to twist along the floor. Nola grabbed the back of her own knee. It was wet. Blood. She was bleeding. Nola stared up at her attacker who was backlit by the skylight, a muddy and hazy blur. But from the outline, from the weapon, the four blades coming out of her attacker's fist like a tiger's claw, Nola knew who it was. The tall Native American woman with the ice blue eyes.
Nola, I believe you've met the curtain, Royal said. Teresa. This is my daughter, Nola.
Raising the tiger's claw into the air, the curtain slashed down, aiming straight at Nola's throat. 85. Nola still didn't scream. She should have, especially as the curtain sliced at the stitches in Nola's neck, reopening her collarbone wound. The pain was unbearable. A lightning shower of anguish that ran from her collarbone to her knee. But even then, Nola still didn't make a sound. Rolling on her side, she pinched the web of skin between her thumb and pointer finger. It was a trick she'd learned from her time with Royal. Squeeze that skin as hard as you want. It can swallow all pain.
You should have killed me.
Nola warned the curtain, still on her side, a long spiderweb of drool dangling from her lips.
You think she didn't ask?
Royal said from across the room, slowly walking toward them.
I'm the one who deals with you. That's my privilege.
Nola tried to get up, tried looking for her gun. The world was still blurred, but on the floor. Something gray. Was that her gun? She reached out. The curtain raised her foot, stomping down on Nola's wrist and digging her heel into the wound that Nola got last night. Nola wanted to howl. Her eyes flooded with tears. Her mouth was open wide like she was in mid-yell, though nothing came out but a high-pitched hiss of air. Twisting from the knife-like agony, Nola pinched the web of skin so hard she thought it'd tear in half.
Nola, you know what the saddest part of all this is?
Royal asked, his voice louder now. He was close. She could feel his fury from here.
This could have all been avoided.
You never change. You're a monster. A murderer.
That's always been your problem. You can't just let a good thing be, can you?
Royal asked, reaching down and picking something up. Nola's gun. He gave it a look, noting its weight.
You always have to spoil it. Everything you touch turns to ash. To shit.
Nola thought she told him to go screw himself, but she was just imagining it. Her nose was running. Her heartbeat was thumping in her forehead, and she couldn't feel the fingers on her hand. Her body was in shock. And suddenly she was thinking of that folded-up greeting card she used to carry around with her in junior high. This will make you stronger. That card was a damn lie.
What really amazes me, though,
Royal added, kneeling down next to her,
is just how fanatical you've become. How many years were you searching, Nola? How much of the Army's resources did you waste looking for me? And for what? So you could track me down in some crap hole Army base in Alaska?
Nola was on her back now, squirming in pain as Royal kneeled next to her. He was in that same pose, at that same angle from when she was little, and he'd sit down on the edge of her bed when he thought Nola was asleep.
Who told you where I was, Nola?
She looked away, refusing to face him.
You're what you've always been. A vampire.
Lifting the gun, Royal pressed it into Nola's cheek, her skin bunching toward her nose. Royal leaned so close, she could see coming down from his lip, in the fleshy white scar she gave him all those years ago, a few stray black hairs that no razor would ever reach. He smelled of brute aftershave and wet wood. Same as all those years ago.
Who was it?
He asked, his finger now around the trigger.
It's a very simple question, Nola. Did they tell you my new name or just that I was in Alaska? Someone needs to pay for that.
Nola took a deep breath, staring up at Royal. It didn't matter how long they were out of each other's lives. Even the most estranged father and daughter could have a whole conversation, an opera of emotion, with just the exchange of a single dark glance.
You're a dead man.
Your skin is lighter, but you still look like a nigger. 3 seconds, Nola. Who told you?
Royal pressed the gun harder into her face.
I need a name. Who told you I was in Alaska?
His finger tightened around the trigger. 2 seconds.
One?
Nola's eyes slid sideways. She looked away.
Wait, he asked. Are you saying... No!
Royal started to laugh.
Jesus H! All this time I thought... I figured someone ratted me out, but...
He laughed again. That rat-a-tat-tat laugh that told her trouble was coming.
When you showed up in Alaska, you weren't even looking for me, were you? You were just painting, just doing your crappy job. But when you spotted me there...
His laugh was louder than ever.
Jesus H! And here I thought you'd been hunting me for years. What a narcissist I am, right?
You're not leaving here alive,
Nola insisted. She believed it, even as the heartbeat in her forehead reached a deafening level.
Don't pass out.
Her eyes flicked back and forth. She tried staying locked on Royal, but the world was now a circle that was shrinking at the edges.
Don't pass out.
Did I miss something? What the hell is going on?
The curtain asked, standing just behind Nola's head.
I thought you said she tracked you to Alaska.
I was wrong,
Royal said, never taking his eyes off Nola, still holding the gun to her face.
Oh, Nola, our little reunion. It wasn't because you're some great detective, was it? You finding me in Alaska, that was just your gift from the universe. A bolt of what you thought was dumb luck. But as always with you, it was just bad luck.
Nola whispered a curse word, her eyes half closed. Her shirt was soaked. She'd lost too much blood.
Mungle, Faber, Stadler.
It's enough. Pull the trigger, the curtain said. Let's get out of here.
Royal moved the gun to Nola's head, directly at her temple, nudging her with the barrel to make sure she was awake.
I want you to know something, Nola,
he said as his finger tightened around the trigger.
Even when you were little, I always knew you were a...
Pop. A splatter of blood hit Royal's face. The blood wasn't Nola's. It sprayed him from above. In the forehead. From where the curtain was standing. Still kneeling, Royal looked up, following the sound. The curtain was already stumbling backward, fighting for air and gripping the bullet hole that was now in her chest. Pop, pop, One shot ricocheted off a metal rack with a spark. A miss. The other hit the curtain above the collarbone. A burst of blood exploded at her neck. Her arms went flat as her body twirled awkwardly at the impact. The metal tiger's claw fell to the floor. The curtain gasped, her blue eyes wide with shock as small flaps of her neck skin waved like a flag. Nola was down on the ground, unconscious. She had no idea what was going on. Pop! Royal grabbed at his own shoulder like he was swatting a mosquito.
What in the f-?
He roared. It wasn't until he put his finger into the bullet hole in his shoulder that he realized he'd been shot. He looked up to see who was responsible. Stepping out from behind a tower of rusted metal desks, Zig held out his gun, still aiming it at Royal.
Drop your gun! Drop it or I swear I'll shoot you again!
Zig shouted, wishing he'd spent even more time with the base's infantry guys when they taught everyone to shoot. Royal dropped his gun, which skittered on the concrete. As the two men locked eyes, a chill crawled up Zig's ribcage. Zig knew that face, knew exactly who he was. They hadn't seen each other in nearly 2 decades, not since that night in the ER. But even back then, these two men had nothing but hate for each other. Zig knew it all those years ago. No heart.
You got old,
Royal said. Zig didn't take the bait. He was too focused on...
Nola! You okay?
He called out. She didn't move. Didn't answer. Zig saw the blood, saw the way her leg was twisted so awkwardly.
Step away! Get away from her!
Zig shouted, racing toward Nola, his guns still on Royal. At Nola's knee, her blood was dark, a deep maroon, and wasn't pulsating. It oozed slowly from her wound. That was good. No active bleeding, Zig realized. Whatever the curtain sliced open, it wasn't an arterial injury. More likely, Nola was unconscious from the pain, not loss of blood.
You better pray she's okay,
Zig said, turning his attention back to... There was a noise. Footsteps. Someone running. Mother trucker. Zig looked to his right, toward the back of the warehouse. The curtain was dead. Nola was exactly where he'd left her. But Royal, along with his gun, were gone. He wouldn't get far.
86. Zig moved slowly, taking small side steps down the dark aisle. His breathing was heavy the entire way. Passing a row of stacked metal bed frames, Zig had his gun out in front of him, following the blood. There were drops along the ground. Royal had run this way, deeper into the warehouse. There was no back door, no back exit. No way out, Zig thought, picking up the pace. He was careful about his speed. Move too fast and he wouldn't see what was coming. Move too slow and Royal would get away. I didn't come here alone, Zig shouted. Security's on their way right now. It was a lie. Zig came here straight from the plane. He tried calling Master Guns. Sue was well. But with the base on lockdown, it would take hours before anyone made their way back here. Still, by saying people were coming, maybe it would get Royal to run. The warehouse was silent. No reaction. Rounding the corner past stalagmites of stacked rusted trash cans, Zig searched the floor for the trail of blood. There wasn't any. Maybe Royal didn't come this way. Or maybe he put pressure on the wound and the bleeding finally stopped. Sticking to the edges of the aisle and gripping the gun tighter than ever, Zig closed his eyes, trying to listen. No heating system. No hum from fluorescent lights. No water running through pipes. For a moment, he held his breath, searching for footsteps, for movement, for anything. The only sound was the high-pitched flow of blood through his own ears, reminding Zig of the familiar quiet that greeted him every day in the... morgue. That's why this place seemed so familiar. That's what this warehouse was. The whole building. Filled with stacks of outdated gurneys, rusted casket carriages, 1960s coffin racks.
Even all the ancient file cabinets, furniture, and old red buzzsaws. Everything here came from the morgue where Zig used to work. The embalming tables on his left, the porcelain tops of them standing up and leaning one against the other like surfboards, were the exact tables Zig worked on when he first came to Dover. As his shoulder slowly brushed against them, he saw chips in the old porcelain, stained pale green from decades of chemicals and use. And now, Zig was thinking of the very first fallen soldier he ever worked on years ago. A 32-year-old pilot whose legs were crushed in a helicopter crash, and whose wife asked that a roll of quarters be put into his casket, since he loved to play the slots. Darren Lee Abramson, Fallen Number One. Reaching the next aisle, Zig peered around the corner, his finger tight on the trigger. Like every other aisle, this one was dark. He couldn't see far, but he could see it was narrow. On both sides were 50-gallon drums, set like massive bowling pins, all of them marked Danger, Formaldehyde, Avoid Inhalation and Skin Contact. Beyond that, the aisle was empty. No one there. Come on, Royal. You gotta be somewhere. Moving to the next aisle and turning the corner, Zig noticed half a dozen ashtray stands, all without their tops. Tucked into one of them were umbrellas, in another were tall wooden rulers, and in a third were long metal rods. Huh. Zig grabbed one of the rods, pulling it out like the sword from the stone. It was an old trocar, a mortician's tool to aspirate fluid from the body. After embalming was finished, Zig would take its sharp steel tip, insert it under the